Welcome to another exciting episode of Live the Adventure Radio. And here's your host, executive producer Bill Hyde, with special guest, historian Bill Potter.
Welcome to Live the Adventure Radio, where we discuss history a week at a time from a Christian world and life view. Hi, I'm Bill Hyde, executive producer of The Extraordinary Adventures of G.A. Henty. In this week's show, historian Bill Potter and I are going to discuss important dates in history from September 18th through the 24th. It's our hope and our prayer that you use this information to not just reflect on what God has done in space and time, but to do the important work of sharing history and inculcating a love of history with your kids. Welcome, Bill.
Good morning, Bill. How are you today?
I'm fantastic, thank you. It's great to be talking with you again. Last time we saw each other was in Scotland, of all places. So you're not in Scotland today. You're somewhere else.
Yeah, I'm in Coarse Gold, California, in the Sierra Nevadas.
So Coarse Gold. I love that.
That's right. It's not a big town, shall we say. But yeah, I'm speaking at church camp up in the Sierra Nevada mountains.
Well, very cool. So look, we've decided what you and I wanted to do was go through and discuss history by the week, maybe going through the days. And this week we're going to discuss the time in history from, you know, the day September 18th through the 24th. And but before we get to those events that we're going to be discussing, we got some great events on the agenda to talk about. But because we haven't done this before, and this we'll call this maybe a pilot episode, let's talk a little bit about for families that are very interested in history and would maybe like to share history. What are the distinctions in history between maybe the secular side of it and the Christian side? We're trying to discuss a Christian world and life view. You know, Goethe had this this idea that faith and unbelief, he said, was the deepest theme in history, the history of the world. And I think he's probably right about that delineation between Christian ideas about people of faith having an idea about history and someone who believes in maybe an origin from, you know, the secular origins or whatever, how that shapes their history completely differently. You want to talk a little bit about the importance of history and these distinctions?
Well, I would say, Bill, that all historians and all people who look at the past do so from a particular presuppositional framework, and how they see man, how they view God and creation and the events of history are going to be colored by their beliefs. Rusai Shreshtuni said all history is religious, and it is, because it is based on what people believe, and all historians have a frame of reference and a worldview from which they preach and from which they teach and instruct others, and that's the same for the reader of history, you know, a person who just wants to learn about the past. They bring to it their own frame of reference, their own ideas. And for the Christian, that is very different from the unbelieving person or historian. You know, most secular, so-called secular historians come at history from a worldview which posits that the world is a product of chance evolution, and everything stems from that. It begins with a rejection of the biblical account of Genesis and goes from there. And so, you know, in the big picture of looking at the past, they're going to be an error often just because they've got the wrong starting point. But for the Christian, the starting point is really the sovereign God of history, who created all things and who manages all things and brings them to fruition according to his plan and purpose. And he uses means to do it. And we typically call those God's providence, or God's providences, the ways in which God manages and controls history, controls modern times. And so the Christian has a different starting point. The starting point's God rather than himself, God rather than his own autonomous reason. And then in terms of living, we know you know, the effects of that. But looking into the future, it affects as well. You know, the Christian looks to the future and knows that God is going to triumph and that history has an end. It's teleological. You know, it's not cyclical like the Marxist would say. It's a straight line that had a beginning and a focal point that is the incarnation of Christ. And everything since then has looked back to that. And then someday there's going to be a reckoning. Man is accountable before God and Christ is going to return. So we have, as we go into the future, we have a different approach, a different way of looking at what's coming. And we need to know the past in order to do that effectively, in order to be good stewards of the faith that God has given us in Him, and the way we study history.
Yeah, you were mentioning, you know, the difference, and I was thinking about if you believe in creation, this is again probably a pretty important point, because if you believe that creation was an act, that's going to create one type of interpretation in history, and if that act was created by a sovereign God, then you've got a whole different flow of history. On the other side, if you think that history is process, is evolutionary process, you're going to not only read history in a different way, you're going to begin to think that you're entirely responsible for history. And of course, the Marxist, you know, dialectic materialism kind of bought into that and shaping history. That was Hegel's gig, right? So, I mean, what you end up with, it doesn't seem like much. People might say, hey, you're splitting hairs, but ask me how many people the communists have murdered over time. And if you take it back, you take it back to this issue, because if you're a secularist and your approach is process rather than act, you end up with some pretty bad stuff out as you project out into the future. And this isn't speculation, something we've seen, haven't we, Bill?
Oh, we have. Multiple millions of people have died for that, underneath that idea that that man can control his own destiny, but he really has no accountability before God. And, you know, they have to break a few eggs to make an omelet when it comes to revolution, you know, a revolutionary approach to history. And mankind has paid so severely for not submitting to the law of God.
Yeah, and you mentioned eggs, but I think the Marxists, where it gets a little ugly, is the referral was using humans as
yes.
manure
yep.
for the future, right? That was
That's
the actual
right.
Marxist
it.
Socialist yep. idea of what the future was. Humans are just manure for the future, and we don't believe that at all. And I wanted to tell you, too, I wanted to give you a little quote in terms of just the importance of history, and that's Chesterton's little piece where he said, just talking about the importance, saying that the long ago and the far away may very well open our eyes up to the here and now, perhaps better than the events that swirl about us with each passing day. So if parents and grandparents are listening to this, Bill, and you have to realize we are, as you said before, presuppositional. We're fish swimming around an aquarium in some sense, in that presuppositional sense. It's important for everybody to not let the 24-hour news cycle shape us, and that, as you said before, we have this stewardship idea from the past. God has given us something, and the 24-hour news cycle to me seems like, it's not that there's never important news or breaking stories, I'm just saying if your world is fed by nothing else but that, you're going to lose track of history and lose track of what God has done for us in space and time.
You're also going to despair because you're not going to be able to see a solution to all the problems that the front page of the news is always about, you know, the depravity, the difficulty, the change in a bad direction that the country's going or the world's going. And you really have no solution. Yeah, I mean, your solution is we got to get this next candidate elected so that we can halt this decline. It really doesn't have anything to do with the next candidate, you know.
Yep.
It can be pretty depressing if your world is focused on the front page of the newspaper, if there were still newspapers.
Well, yeah, that's a great observation. So let's move into, with that kind of context, let's move into talking about a guy, something that happened on September 18th that families should talk about together and should celebrate And that's a guy who, if he would have let circumstances around him shape his career path, his life, the way that we've just been advocating, so much of the civil rights movement wouldn't have exist. So much of freedom and opportunity for African Americans would have never taken place. And I'm talking about Booker T. Washington on the 18th, Bill, of September. Booker T. Washington gave his famous speech at the Cotton States Exposition, in which he advocated what he called Negro self-help and self-sufficiency. This was in 1895. You want to talk just a little bit about that?
Yes, they had the big Cotton States Exposition in Atlanta, and one of the most important spokesman for the, you might say, the black communities in America at that time. He's certainly the most famous one, but this speech is going to make him really the national leader in that sense. Booker T. Washington, a man who was born into slavery, who taught himself to read and to write, a man who really did, seize the opportunities that came his way, managed to get a college education at Hampton Institute in Virginia, now Hampton University, and then took on today we'd call it the presidency, or the leadership of Tuskegee Institute, which the way Tuskegee is described today and other institutions similar to it, a traditionally black university. And there he remained the rest of his life as a spokesman for the people, especially who had been born into slavery and whose descendants now were growing up in the latter quarter of the 19th century. And he gave a speech in which he, in essence, ignored the difficulties and the problems and the racial animosities that surrounded the culture, and spoke directly to the next generation of young black men and women who were, some of whom had not experienced slavery, but were living in a society that circumscribed how far they could go in the world and whether they could vote or not. And there were lots of difficulties and problems and animosities. And he didn't totally ignore them, but what he said was, he was positive. He said, if you want to succeed in this world, you need to, I guess the common expression is pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. But he really concentrated on what he called industry and thrift, intelligence, develop your intelligence, acquire property, and do it by hard work and education. Those were his two themes, hard work and education. And you can take your place in this society, even though the cards are stacked against you. And he himself was just a perfect example of doing just that. And so at this exposition, which really was a platform for someone such as he, because the exposition was run by the White South for the White South, and he was invited to speak, and he really brought to the fore the ideas and the works that were necessary for his community to really improve and raise their status in life and really prove that they could do as well as anyone, and that they could prosper. And it was a brilliant and effective speech that captured the minds and the imaginations of not just the former freedmen, not just the black community, but also captured the minds and the ideas of many whites, including philanthropists, who were willing to invest in those goals.
I love Bill. Of course, he was a very intelligent man, but I love one of his quotes. I've got it on my computer, and success is to be measured not so much by the position that one has reached in his life as by the obstacles which by he has overcome. So he was more interested in measuring someone by the obstacles that they've overcome and saying, okay, if you're going to look at a success criteria, not are you a senator's son or a fortunate one, as the old Creedence Clearwater song says, but what have you come through? You know, what have you, and man, do we need to hear this message today or what? I mean, this guy speaks to this generation, irrespective of your race, but certainly inner city blacks could do well by reading up from slavery. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, let me tell you a quick story. I know we've only got so much time to talk about each of these things, but years ago, my wife's grandfather was a member, a chapter leader of the Birch Society, and he asked me to join. And I think I probably joined at the beginning just because of family pressure, like, you know, your grandfather, wife's grandfather asked you to join. And so I joined. But so guess what political propaganda? Did I get a book by Robert Welch or by John McManus or something, or Susan Huck? No. The first thing he said, you know, thanks for joining. Here's this book. And it was Up From Slavery.
Oh, yeah.
That's how he said you're going to begin your membership of this organization is by reading Up From Slavery. Now that's telling too, isn't it? They had that published and were handing them out at fairs and everything else. And this book's got like it's got parts about public speaking. I mean, this is like a self-help book extraordinaire. If you've never read it, your kids should read it, your grandkids should read it. And we should be talking about this book and this man in our culture.
Well, there are reasons why we're not. I mean, it is a book for every young man entering into the into the workaday world and looking at life and getting started. You ought to read that book and really see what see the principles for a successful life and. The reason it's not read today, or the reason it's not read like it used to be, and it's not considered like it used to be, is because the very civil rights community that was spawned by his inspiration and others have rejected Booker T. Washington. In fact, I've read plenty of articles where he's called an Uncle Tom, People are not encouraged to, to learn from his life. And the reason is he was willing to accommodate the conditions that were, the odds that were stacked against him. He was willing to work with the whites of his day. He didn't agitate for getting rid of Jim Crow laws. I mean, he grew up in the days of Jim Crow, which is sort of the shorthand term that was used to keep black people from voting and had various kinds of segregation laws in different states and in different jurisdictions, but laws that were designed to keep the races separate. He didn't address those issues. He didn't dwell on the problems and the negatives. And because he wasn't an activist for trying to get more people to vote or an activist for trying to take on the white man in his own den and defeat him, more like W.E.B. Du Bois, who was the other great black leader of the same period, a socialist and a man who had a very different view of the world and a view of what black youth should be doing, and whose views are the ones that are admired and read about today, not Booker T. Washington as a rule. And so eventually he becomes marginalized and his work becomes marginalized as a more activist and revolutionary sort of worldview takes place within black leadership. And then eventually, of course, the creation of the NAACP and the civil rights movement and all of that. While at the beginning they looked to Booker T. Washington for inspiration, I think there's a big philosophical shift over the 20th century. And he's shunted to the back of the bus by his own folks. Yeah. So I think you're right here in that he needs to be rediscovered. There's some very good biographies, and of course his own. He wrote five books, and Up From Slavery was an instant classic.
It's a classic, and again, just it's easy to find online. You can probably get a free copy if you got a Kindle or something. So that's just a great resource. Go check it out. And it flows quite nicely into something else that happened on the 18th, and that was that Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850. And do you want to just go through that a little bit, just talk a little bit about, because it's you're going to get one dose of this in a regular public school high school textbook, but there's a lot of ramifications to this.
Yes, after the war with Mexico in 1846, one of the desires of certain congressmen was to pass some laws restricting, you know, when the war comes to an end, some laws, amendments to various bills that would restrict the expansion of slavery, of slave states, into the western territories that would be acquired from Mexico. The territories that would become California, New Mexico, Arizona, those areas eventually would become territories. And there were those in the north who wanted to prohibit Southerners from settling those areas with their slaves. And the result was a great deal of combat and difficulty in Congress over that particular issue. And with the closing of the Mexican War, we find that the political situation has changed a little bit, and men are starting to vote based on their section rather than their political parties. And it's lining up North against South in Congress. In fact, in 1850, because of that, there was a very strong secession movement in the South. There were those who wanted to break from the Union, and there are plenty of historians who believe that had the South seceded in 1850, they would have had a much higher chance of success than they did 10 years later. And so it was that kind of a crisis. I mean, it was a huge crisis, a political crisis within the Congress. And so the old lions who had been sort of ruling over America from Congress for the previous 30 or 40 years, Henry Clay, John C. Calhoun, and Daniel Webster, marshaled their congressional forces, and they put together what became known as the Compromise of 1850. As had been done in the past when there were crises, these men were able to patch together agreements that everybody could live with but didn't like. And the Compromise of 1850 ended up being one of those, and it had a lot of different component parts to it. You know, California is going to come into the Union as a free state, for instance. And according to the Missouri Compromise of 1820, Southern California should have been a slave state. And that sort of thing. So there were compromises that were made on both sides. The radicals at both ends of the spectrum didn't like it and voted against it. But the middle got together and patched together this compromise. But one of the elements of it was the Fugitive Slave Act. And already there on the books were laws that required runaway slaves from the South, fugitive slaves, those who had either gotten to the North on the Underground Railroad or had successfully crossed over the Mason-Dixon line into wherever, Ohio or Pennsylvania, that they had to be returned to their masters if caught. But the Fugitive Slave Act put teeth into the laws, and it was such that it now required U.S. Marshals to capture runaway slaves and return them to their masters. And they put incentive with it. And that incentive was, you know, you get, if you arrested a runaway, you got paid, I don't know, $10. If you returned him south. And so, and there were those from the South who were always on the hunt for runaway slaves in the North, but now they had federal backing for recovering their property, which they considered stolen, and return them runaways south. So that was the that was called the Fugitive Slave Act. And it triggered a huge reaction among abolitionists, those who wanted to abolish slavery right now, particularly in New England and parts of Ohio and other places. They vowed they would not obey this law. And it was essentially this aspect of the Compromise of 1850 was nullified by various groups of people in the states, in the northern states. And they agitated for their states actually to nullify the law. So it created a great problem for the abolitionists and for those who were trying to retrieve their runaway slaves, of which there were not a huge number, but there were some, and this gave a federal sanction to their capture and return. So that's the Fugitive Slave Act, but it resulted in riots in Massachusetts, and it also resulted in federal marshals and local sheriffs getting involved in the situation too, because they might be anti-slavery, not necessarily, but they might be, and thus the orders of the federal government conflict with their own particular viewpoint. So that came down on the same day as that was in 1850.
So real quickly, so, what was Mr. Lincoln's position on the Fugitive Slave Act?
Well, Mr. Lincoln was a Illinois railroad lawyer at the time, and I would guess, I don't know the quotable answer to your question, but I would guess that he probably was. You know what? I don't know. I don't know what his position on that was. He probably was opposed to it. I would guess he was opposed to it, although he might not have been, because he did belong to the American Colonization Society, which their purpose was to get rid of all the black people from North America that they could by purchasing them and sending them back to Africa on ships. Mm-hmm. And he was a member of that organization. So he... I don't know what is.
Yeah, we'll look into that. Maybe talk about that. We'll talk about that the next time. Let's move on to.
Okay.
I always liked it. I'm sitting here in Illinois, and since Lincoln's usually, his branding has been such that he's been on a certain side. It's always fun to expose. You know, he's a guy that's on a lot of different sides. So it's always fun to just expose some other sides to the man, a guy that's been all over the place. But on the 19th, yes, Something bizarre happened that we can talk about. That's probably not quite, doesn't have quite the depth and breadth of other things we were just talking about. But on the 19th, Soviet in 1959, geez, I would have been 1 year old. 1 year old. Soviet dictator Nikita Khrushchev threw a fit while visiting in Los Angeles. He wasn't allowed to visit Disneyland and see what became his favorite Mickey Mouse. So yes. Khrushchev doesn't get to see Mickey or Minnie. What the heck happened there?
Oh, I mean, it was a tragic situation, Bill. Nikita Khrushchev. For those who, this is the first time they've heard his name. He was the sort of supreme dictator of the Soviet Union, and he was a big, kind of corpulent, coarse, peasant-like figure in a way, but a devoted communist who had come out of World War II, ranked pretty highly within the panoply of Soviet communist authority, and he had become the president of the Soviet Union, and he came to the United States. He hated America and hated the United States, and stood in the United Nations, took off his shoe, and banged it on the table and hollered that we will bury you, to the Americans.
Right.
That had something to do with the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. But the reality was, I mean, that was great political theater. The reality was there were aspects of American culture that Khrushchev really admired and liked and was entertained by. It's interesting. Adolf Hitler had the same attitude. He believed Americans were, Americans were effeminate and wimps and would never fight in World War II. But he did like cowboys and Indians. And so, Hitler used to watch cowboy and Indian movies. I mean, he loved Hopalong Cassidy and, all that whole genre of film. Well, Khrushchev was the same way, and he admired Disneyland, and he liked Mickey Mouse for some reason. You couldn't say that he was a Mickey Mouse kind of guy, but that's he was attracted to it. He liked American cinema. He liked the cartoons, and he got to come to the United States. Who knows? Maybe that's why he actually came. He thought he could go to Disneyland. And have a swell time. And so when he asked to do it, the American authorities said, no, the security problem is too great. Because there were plenty of people in the United States that, of course, hated Khrushchev and hated the Russians. And, there was a certain element of danger because of the Cold War between the two empires. And Khrushchev was prohibited from having his little side trip. He never did get to Disneyland, as far as I know.
He probably had someone buy a shirt for him or something. Wouldn't you think he'd want to take?
Could you
that
just
back.
See him in the Politburo wearing a Mickey Mouse shirt?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. In the little hats like Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon wore in the Mickey Mouse Club.
They could have had their own in one of those big dark suits that these guys only wore.
All the Politburo probably could dress up like that. It would have been a little different type of meeting.
Yeah, had a little levity.
Levity, yeah.
Pretty sober guy. Well, they're not sober guys, actually. They're somber guys.
Yeah.
They're not sober guys. So.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that's a good study. And, as just really to think about, conditions really were very different, as you and I both can remember when we were young.
Yeah.
This seems like just pure spectacle at this point. But the relations were tense. And mutual assured destruction was the overarching political theory between our country and the USSR. And so the gravity of these things was much larger. And it's almost, well, I won't say it's impossible, but it's very difficult to, if you weren't there, to put yourself back into that place, because this guy was a character. A master. He was a little bit like Putin. He was a master of psychology. You never know how much was real, how much he was upset, and how much was just a bit of a game that he was playing, because he was always pounding something, as you said, Bill, with his shoe. And it was just a question of what it was that he was pounding. So,
and people knew he wasn't somebody who was necessarily trifling either, because he was the commissar at Stalingrad that was in charge of mowing down Russian troops that retreated. He's the guy that set up the machine guns behind the lines when they would send in suicide attacks on the Germans. The Russian soldiers would be destroyed and driven back, and the Russians had machine guns waiting for them for retreating. And he was the guy that was sent there to put steel behind the Russian war effort. So he had a history of if people looked at Khrushchev, they really did see the essence of the Soviet, the tough, violent, we will bury you, Soviet Union.
Yep.
And it's interesting that, Christians and people in church in America, that was a time when they did a lot of reading of the front page of the newspaper and said, woe is me. How can we be rescued out of this? And they really became pessimistic and angry. And I think, growing up, a lot of the people that a lot of the adults that I knew, Christian adults, were despairing and wringing their hands because of the Cold War, because of Khrushchev. They took their eyes off the victory that Christ is going to bring, and became very pessimistic and saw the world, being destroyed by these people and hiding in their bunkers, even Christians. And we now, looking back, you see the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1990, That, I mean, that would consider the most improbable event, one of the most improbable events of the 20th century that nobody saw coming. But even Christians were caught up in that Cold War mentality that, you know, Satan's ruling the world and the Soviet Union is his handmaid. And, you know, that's really not the case at all.
Well, the guy in heaven laughs at such things. The guy in heaven laughs at such things. That's part of what we read about in Psalms, right? I mean, so we know that we have to be careful when we look at, as I said, the 24-hour news cycle or even a smaller news cycle to project what we would call newspaper exegesis on, you know, to try to figure things out just based on that news event. And it's time right now to take a short break. We'll be back right after this.
Heirloom Audio presents the story of a young man...
We must be ready.
...who takes on the mightiest government in the world.
Beric! They are here!
Who?
The Romans!
...and discovers someone he never expected.
Have you heard the teachings of a man named Christus?
It's Beric the Briton on The Extraordinary Adventures of G.A. Henty.
Follow me, men! To the wall!
Featuring Kathy Sarah from Downton Abbey, Honeysuckle Weeks from Foyle's War, and John Rhys-Davies from The Lord of the Rings.
Citizens of Rome, Emperor Nero!
Starring Tom Baker from Doctor Who, and Emmy Award winner Brian Cox from Braveheart and The Bourne Identity.
I will grant you the desire of your heart. You shall meet your God.
Live the adventure with Beric the Briton. Go to BericTheBriton.com. That's BericTheBriton.com.
And we're back again talking about what God has done in history. Bill Hyde here with Bill Potter. But let's move on to the 20th. You've got another great explorer, Magellan, sets out to circumnavigate the world in 1519.
Yes.
An amazing date, September 20th. Magellan sets out.
Ferdinand Magellan was an amazing character. The Atlantic Ocean was and is the most dangerous ocean in the world. And if you can imagine those little small wooden ships venturing out, huge numbers of them were lost, never to be seen again. Venturing out into the Atlantic Ocean was often a fatal enterprise. And Magellan had a little fleet. You know, he had a number of ships that he was going to lead, not just into the Atlantic Ocean, but all the way around the world. He's going to circumnavigate the globe. To everyone's knowledge, no one had ever done that before. And today there isn't, we still don't know if anybody had ever accomplished that prior to Magellan. I suppose it's possible in ancient times, but we don't know about it. So he was really the first, in at least modern history that we're aware of, that set out on that and actually succeeded, although he himself did not succeed. He got very seriously killed in the Philippines, so he didn't make it home. But he did, his fleet under his command did successfully circumnavigate the globe, although he himself was left in the Philippines.
And the beginning of a lot of trade routes, and just kind of like running a 4-minute mile. Once somebody can do it, then it seems to empower others to give it a shot. And so I think, could you recommend a book on Magellan? There's probably not a lot of good ones, but is there any resources on Magellan that you think are worthy of
I don't know that there are any biographies of him. There may be. If there are, I'm not familiar with them. He's usually read in the larger context of the creation and advance of the Spanish Empire. Although he may have been Portuguese himself, but it's really part of the it's part of the great advance of Spain and Portugal. And the expansion of their empire throughout the 16th century. It was a remarkable accomplishment. They conquered all of South America and Central America. They named the Philippines, you know, when Magellan came along, and there were 1,000 Philippine islands. He didn't see them all, but he saw some of them, and he claimed them for Spain. and he named them after Philip II, King Philip II. So they became the Philippines, and they became actually, you know, Magellan's voyage results in the Philippines being declared Spanish territory. And when they had the military ability to occupy the Philippines and conquer the natives and establish a Spanish government there, they planted the Roman Catholic Church in the middle of in the Philippines. So it's the only nation that could be part of that was part of Christendom in the Pacific when Magellan claimed the Philippines. It's a major country. Mm-hmm. Became Roman Catholic, and to this very day it still is, and it is because of Magellan. So it really it's part of the march of Spain and Portugal, but especially Spain. Spain becomes the great empire of the 16th century. And it, you know, somewhat ironic, a lot of people, you know, they think of the 16th century, they think of the Reformation, because that is the Reformation century. But for most historians, when they think of the 16th century, what they think of is the Spanish Empire, as they conquered the world.
And yeah, let's not forget it was the Spanish, you know, Empire that set him out on that quest and supported him and gave him the ships and kind of created that condition. Who was his sponsor?
His sponsor was the, you know, the King of Spain, Philip, and he was subsidized by the government to do this exploration, as had Columbus, Columbus before him, and then the conquistadors that went to South America and conquered the various people there. Sponsored by the Spanish government. Spain wanted more than just trade. They did want trade, and they did want to find shorter routes to the Far East and all of that. But Spain was bent on reconquering Europe for the Catholic Church, and they had developed the only professional army in Europe. And making wars, fighting wars, is hugely expensive. And so, you know, part of the Spanish conquest of the West was to acquire the wealth so they could continue their war against Protestantism and against Spanish hegemony in Europe. So there were lots of moving parts to the Spanish Empire. They needed financing, and that's the gold and silver of South America, and dominating the trade routes that were opened up by Magellan and other men like him was all part of the amazing growth of this small nation, really. I mean, Spain geographically is a fairly large European nation, but to say that they were able to expand their language, their culture, their church to millions and millions of people is still true today in terms of culture, in terms of church and language and history and all of that. And Magellan was a key part of that.
On September 21st, let's move into another emperor, another guy that Protestants and Catholics would know a little bit about. You can see him in the new Luther movie. There's a little bit of a, when I say new Luther movie, I'm talking about black and white and color there. But but Charles on the 21st, Charles V passed away on that
day. Yes.
Let's talk about Charles V for a little bit. I mean, this Holy Roman, you know, empire is a pretty big deal, and he inherits this thing at a pretty young age, right? I mean, he had some issues. He had a guy like Luther on one side of him, and he had the Muslims at the gates of Vienna on the other side, and talk about a pincer movement, right? For a guy I think he's a guy that's been maligned in some ways. He was a man with great vision in many ways. But let's talk a little bit about Charles V.
Well, Charles V took place as the the head of the Spanish Empire, and because of his family connections, and I mean, he really began ruling at the age of 19. I mean, how many 19-year-olds can take over something like the Spanish Empire in the early part of the 16th century? And then because of his dynastic family connections, he also became the Holy Roman Emperor. And the Holy Roman Emperor actually was, in some ways, some saw it as the successor to the Caesars, in that he ruled over all the German states in Europe. The Holy Roman Emperor was, he ruled over Germany. There was no such thing as Germany. There were just German states, and there were a couple hundred of them. And each one was ruled by a prince.
An elector, and, yeah.
An elector, and they weren't all electors, but there were a number of electors who then answered to Charles. And, of course, Martin Luther came along in Saxony and challenged the church. And Charles V really didn't like carrying water for the Pope. He and the papacy had their run-ins all through his life. He saw himself as really above them and the papacy being interfering. And so when it came to Martin Luther, he himself had to deal with the little German monk, you know, the rebellion in Saxony. And the whole Protestant Reformation took place on Charles's watch. And, of course, he was a very devout Roman Catholic. But because of his position and because of the tension and the animosities between the papacy and other Roman Catholic emperors, there was really uneasy relations pretty much throughout his reign. But you're right, he actually did run into a series of problems and difficulties, which actually turned out to be helpful to the Reformation. Charles V couldn't turn all of his guns on the Protestants. He couldn't just march into Saxony or any other place where Lutheranism now was spreading like wildfire. He just couldn't march his armies in there because he had other bigger problems with Islam. You know, the Muslims had taken over several countries in southern Europe and were on the march into Europe again. There have been successive waves of Muslim invasions of Europe. And this one was very serious, and Vienna was kind of considered the capital of the Holy Roman Empire. Charles himself spent most of his time in Italy, but Vienna was really at the core of the Holy Roman Empire. And so the Muslim armies were laying siege to Vienna during his reign, and they had to be stopped. They could not allow the Turks to overwhelm Christendom and to bring Islam into Europe on a broad scale. They knew what that meant. They had seen the triumphal march of Islam across North Africa and into Spain and through Southern Europe, conquering. And so Charles had to stop them. And so his military efforts were facing east. In fact, he even approached the Protestants, the Protestant princes of Germany. He approached them and said, we have to stop Islam. It's a greater threat than our differences. And in fact, some Protestant princes actually did send troops to help Charles defeat Islam. Very interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that one of those electors was his uncle. Frederick the Wise, the guy that protected Luther. And so that's,
yes.
All of this is very intertwined, as we said when we first started.
Yes.
And to just another little quick point as we move on, but this little business of what I've heard historians call salutary neglect, where a prince or a government is off dealing with problem X, and meanwhile situation Y is you know, gestating like an egg or something, and growing. And certainly this country, if Charles II in England probably had nothing to do at all, or Charles I you probably would have a very different situation here, because we were kind of allowed to, in this country, allowed to develop something that became strong enough that then they couldn't come back and get it once they realized what happened. So,
yeah,
familiar theme in history.
Yep, that's happened. It's happened, you know, multiple times. You know, Charles also inherited the Habsburg family empire, and that included the Netherlands. And so he ended up having to march his army across France to get to Netherlands, and he fought against the Valois of France. France was always fighting with Charles and with the Spanish, the Spanish Empire. France was a rival, and they hated the Spaniards and Charles V. And so even though France was a Catholic country, they fought against, it didn't trump their difficulties with Spain, and they fought a war with them, and as did the Netherlands. So Charles is fighting in the Netherlands, he's fighting in France, he is expanding the Spanish Empire in the New World, and receiving the wealth that flows into his coffers from there. And he has different kings that are they're subordinate to him, they're supposed to be serving him, and some are and some aren't. And then you've got the Protestant Reformation burning its way across Germany, and then into France and the Netherlands, especially in the Netherlands. They fight a 100 years war against Charles and his successors before they gain their independence. But he rules over 4 million square kilometers or miles of I think it's kilometers of land. This single man is superpowers, but too many things going on, and God uses it to the great advantage of the spread of the Protestant churches. It's one of those things where, had Charles been able to focus on killing Protestants, theoretically, it's probably silly to even think about it, because it didn't happen, but he could have devoted a lot more time and effort to stopping Martin Luther and those who followed him. So,
yeah. What you can do with that information, and what Bill and I are both advocating, is as you look at the things that are swirling around us with each passing day in this 24-hour news cycle, say, all right, what's God doing with this? And really, I think that's the strongest message, because in some of these cases, there's no way you could have predicted the outcome if you were to look at it at the time that you were analyzing it, because God doesn't need us, and He doesn't need us to shape. He doesn't, if I was hungry, I wouldn't ask you, right? I mean, so it's the same thing for history, but it's fascinating when you look at the things that are going on in the world through God's eyes. As you said before, Bill, you can rest. Certainly there are things to do. Certainly we are called to action, but you can rest knowing that there's a sovereign God that's using all of the details of history, a sparrow falling, the hairs of your head falling, and all of history using, and in this progression forward to this culmination.
Yes.
We talked earlier, I mentioned our country and how we were sort of neglected in this sense and allowed this thing to hatch over here. On the 22nd, Bill, Nathan Hale, probably really one of my favorite guys and patriots, hung by the British as a spy. And, I'm not sure that he said this, but I think we give him credit for saying that he regretted that he has but one life to live for his country. And that happened in a great year, 1776.
Yes.
Nathan Hale.
He was not the right person to be doing what he did. He was a young patriot, I believe from Connecticut, and George Washington needed intelligence about what the British were doing on Long Island. He didn't have contact with the spies that he was just beginning to infiltrate into the British lines. And Nathan Hale volunteered to go into the British camp and you know, just as a local farmer and gather intelligence and get it to the American soldiers, get it to the American army. But Nathan Hale was a big guy, and he was known to be a patriot. Everybody from his area where he lived knew that he was one of the leading patriots. He was outspoken about it. And he wasn't particularly good at hiding either himself or his viewpoints, but he volunteered for this espionage work. And he walked into the British camp, and he was immediately recognized by some of his neighbors who were Tories. And he said, "That's Nathan Hale. He's a patriot." And they grabbed him, and sure enough, he was an American spy. And Washington felt terrible about what happened and the results and such. He didn't know Nathan Hale, I believe. But he was the wrong man at the wrong time. And he was hanged for spying. That was the rule. If you were caught within enemy lines without wearing an enemy uniform, you know, wearing the uniform of the enemy or not wearing a uniform, then you had to be considered an espionage agent, and he was. And he was hanged. But several people did witness his execution, and one of them did record those as his last words. So whether they, you know, based on the word of one person who claimed to be an eyewitness, it was believed that he did say, I only regret that I have but one life to give for my country. Whether he said it or not, that phrase, that statement inflamed the colonies and helped the patriot cause. It became an iconic phrase in American history. So
certainly.
I like to think that he did say it.
But, yeah, and it came from great
incontrovertible proof.
Yeah, Bill. We have to move on a little bit here because we got 5 minutes maybe to cover two more things. But I would always like to bring up the fact that his, especially in the context of this, that his parents and his pastor, you know, sort of created this guy. His parents were Puritans. His dad was a deacon, and his pastor tutored him. I wouldn't call it, you know, full throttle homeschooling or whatever, because they sent him out to get some to be tutored by a sharp guy. But there's a reason he was able to. Somebody poured cement in this guy's, creating a foundation for this of character for this guy's life.
Yep.
He would have
yep.
never done these things if he would have assumed that the life was just sound and history was sound and fury and it had no meaning. He certainly was someone who we could describe as, Bill said earlier, that understood God's sovereignty in history, walked into that camp. Certainly he didn't walk into the camp to be hanged, but it gave him a kind of courage that you don't have if you don't think someone's got your back, if everything's just chaos and random, right? So that gave him strength of character and fortitude, and people remember him for that when he, as a young man. So this wasn't just something that he got his gumption up to and did. This is a guy that lived his life this way. On the 23rd, we've got something else that happens. Pretty cool. We're talking about Lewis and Clark here. They get back from this long voyage, Bill. Like I said, we've only got a couple minutes here to talk about the 23rd and 24th. But, you know, how can you sum up Lewis and Clark? That Jeffersonian period, right? How can you sum that up in a couple minutes? It's tough stuff, but certainly changed the world forever, especially the United States.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the great expedition that explored and mapped, not just geographically, but culturally, mapped the area of the Louisiana Purchase that Thomas Jefferson had worked out with Napoleon, and the huge amount of territory that was basically unexamined and undiscovered by Americans. You know, some people had been out that way, but this was an expedition financed by the government with two remarkable captains, Meriwether Lewis and Clark, and they took over two years on the ground exploring the rivers and valleys and mountains and Indian tribes and flora and fauna of America, of the American West. Just a remarkable achievement, and rightly celebrated today.
Rightly celebrated, and I gotta, I got to, not to buzz through them too quick, but I got a feeling they're going to pop up on our radar again as we analyze history and American history. They set kind of a bar for you know, recording what they did, and so we've got a lot of information on those guys. So
yes, that's true. Great deal.
Yep. What a great expedition to study. And then on the 24th, you know, I threw this in as a way to kind of conclude the week, but you end up with the Byzantine Empire, really the end of it kind of is in sight, because you've got you know, the Manuel Komnenos, I think that's how you pronounce it, Komnenos.
Komnenos,
yeah, who is the last emperor of the Byzantine Empire, and it's over. But not, I mean, when did this start with Theodosius? I mean, is this really 1,000 years?
Well, the Byzantine Empire is actually the sort of the Middle Eastern Christian church, in contrast or distinction to the Roman Catholic Church, which is ruled by the Pope from Rome. In the Eastern Church, you have the Byzantine Church and the Byzantine Empire, ruled initially by Caesars, you know, by Roman emperors. They moved the capital to Constantinople from Rome and established what was called eventually the Byzantine Empire. And it was very different families. The Komnenos was the last emperor of that particular family line, and had actually, you know, restored it. But the Byzantine Empire did last 1,000 years, and it doesn't really totally come to an end until Constantinople falls to the Muslims in the 15th century.
About 300 years later. So it's still, just like Rome, it doesn't kind of end on some day. Like, you know, the Roman Empire collapsed today. This day in history. No, things kind of, you know, so as you look at the United States, unless we do something, you have to realize there's a kind of a slow grind as civilizations end.
Right,
they don't always end in a day.
Yes.
Yeah. It just kind of slips away into dust, like you're saying. This is one that did over time, but it took 300 more years. And, it really just, what would you say it would be, let's kind of finish this way in terms of like a little bit of a moral decline. When you talk about these things and how things slip away, they have great, strong, powerful ideas that act as, you know, binding agents that keep empires together. And it's difficult to hold that together. The glue that holds a people together used to be the Christian faith in this country. But as that slips away and as other ideas become preeminent or ultimate, as we were discussing earlier, the binding power, the stickiness, the glue that holds it all together starts allowing, like a centrifuge, right, all these things to kind of push outward, and you no longer have a agreement, some common thread of belief that holds you together. And I think that's
right.
True for all of these great empires, and that probably was the case with the Byzantines as well.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, that's true, and there's another factor too in this is, you know, we're talking about Byzantium and the decline. That's right in the midst of the Crusades, also, and they end up fighting against, you know, fellow Crusaders. So, you know, the whole idea of Christendom and Christian ethics and biblical law, that all deteriorates during that period too, and Christian infighting, and the church just becomes so diluted, you know, over time as well, and you know, that gets arrested from time to time in history with great spiritual awakening, with great revivals, and I think that Byzantium never experienced that, but certainly the church in the West did with the Protestant Reformation, and it certainly happened in the United States with the Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening. So although peoples and empires Christian ones experienced periods of decline, and it looks like extinction. God moves in a massive way on the hearts of men to restore his church and to bring biblical religion back into a broad expansion of God's kingdom. And I think that, you know, when we look at the Byzantine Empire and the Roman Empire and Spanish Empire and all of these groups down through history, the ones to whom God laughs, or God laughs at because of their pretensions over him, that from time to time God chooses to restore his church through a nation or in a particular geographical area or just among a small group of faithful remnant people. And he's never without a witness. And I think, you know, Christians from the beginning who've been faithful have prayed for revival and have prayed for the Holy Spirit's transformation of the hearts of men on a broad front. And so I think as we compare ourselves to these declining empires, we need to remember that and pray that God will once again bring reformation and bring revival to his people and to expand his kingdom in our own time and in our own place, because he's done it before over and over again. And while these various empires collapse and disappear, his church remains, and he brings great revival from time to time. And I think we need to pray for that.
Bill, I couldn't think of a better way to end the show. So thank you very much for all of that amazing information and being with me today. And I would like just to say to the audience that you can join Bill and I again next week as we tackle another week in history as viewed through a Christian worldview, with information that you can share with your family and your friends. And we look forward to seeing you next week or listening to you next week, Bill, and hanging out and talking about more history with the Christian World and Life View. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Yep. You bet.
Today's show was sponsored by Landmark Events. To learn more about the tours, conferences, and retreats that Landmark Events provides, simply go to landmarkevents.org. That's landmarkevents.org. This show was also sponsored by Beric the Briton. If you love stories about ancient Rome, gladiators, and yes, even a hint of romance, you'll love Beric the Briton. To learn more about this epic audio adventure from Heirloom Audio Productions, go to BericTheBriton.com. That's BericTheBriton.com. Join us again next week when Bill and the Live the Adventure team bring us another exciting episode of Live the Adventure Radio. Until then, keep living the adventure.